You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And we're proud to be sponsored by Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876. There's a kind of psychological thriller crime feel to today's episode of Bookmark. Our studio guest is Rory Clements. He'll be talking about his novel Nucleus. We'll also hear from crime writer Alison Bruce on her new novel I Did It For Us, and Ruth Wade and Betsy Reevely, writer and publisher, respectively, will also be chatting to us. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Rory Clements.
Thank you, Lee.
Nice to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But talking there in the introduction about these two genres, psychological thriller and crime, there's often quite a lot of overlap between the two, do you find?
Yes, I mean, Where thriller ends and crime begins, I'm not quite sure. But I think that the Crime Writers Association, of which I'm a member, would happily accept either genres as part of crime.
Yes, I wonder where one becomes the other, because often a psychological thriller has crime in it and a crime novel has psychological elements in it.
I suppose if it's a whodunit, it's a sort of crime novel. And if it's more towards James Bondy, it would be a thriller. In certainly my novel, you're not quite sure who's who until the denouement.
Yes, I was going to say, would you define yours as a psychological thriller or crime?
I think I'd just call it a thriller, actually. I mean, there's a psychological element to any thriller, but I think that's the word I would use.
And on the front of your books, it says, for fans of Robert Harris, and he is the master at that kind of genre, isn't he?
Really? He's pretty good, isn't he?
He is pretty good. Yeah. He's pretty successful. Who else is up there, do you think? Apart from yourself, of course.
I always loved Freddie Forsyth. Odessa File and all his other books. John Buchan was there in my youth. You know, the 39 Steps and James Bond, I just mentioned. I read all his books when I was a teenager and I thought they were brilliant.
Of course, Ian Fleming, of course. Well, we will give you a proper introduction after your first choice of music, which is Stockton Gala Days, the MTV Unplugged version. You very much wanted that one, by 10,000 Maniacs. Why this?
10,000 Maniacs was basically the singer, Natalie Merchant, who went solo soon after this. But the whole album is wonderful. But I picked out this because it... In the middle of a dark winter, and we've had a long, long winter, it brings summer. I mean, she talks about wildflower fever and light laying down in the grass, and it cheers you up in the dark days. She's got a wonderful voice.
Stockton Gala Days by 10,000 Maniacs, the first choice of music from our studio guest on Bookmark today, Rory Clements. Rory was an associate editor at Today newspaper, followed by stints at the Daily Mail and Evening Standard. He's been writing novels full-time since 2007, and his second novel, Revenger, won the Crime Writers Association Ellis Peters Historical Award in 2010. He's written 8 books in the John Shakespeare series, all set in the 16th century. His latest novel, novel Nucleus is the second to feature Professor Tom Wilde. Set in 1939, after Germany's invasion of Czechoslovakia, and with the world on the brink of war, it juggles storylines of espionage, political conflict, romance, and the race to create the first atom bomb. So Rory, set in 1939, as I say, is Nucleus. Corpus, the first of the trilogy, set in 1936. Your previous books were in the 16th century. So why the jump forward in time?
Well, I wanted a change. I'd written about a million words on my 16th century protagonist, John Shakespeare, and I thought I needed a change, and I loved the 1930s, and fortunately my editor, Kate Parkin at Bonnie O'Zafra Books, she loves that era, as does my agent, so it was very easy to persuade them and to work on it together.
What is it about that era that you love?
1930s, it was it's sort of slightly forgotten era in some ways. You know, the war was so huge that came after it. We forget quite how tense and pivotal some of those events were. 1936, you know, which my first novel, which had the year of three kings in this country, the year of the Berlin Olympics, the year that the Nazis marched into the Rhineland, the year that Stalin began his purges. It was a huge year, and 1939 likewise, another incredible year. All year, I imagine everyone knew they were going to end in war. It was a matter of when, but life carried on in the meantime.
Atmosphere at that time, as you say. You've got this mixture of fear, expectation, some scepticism, and a sort of element of hedonism as well.
I think so. Yeah, everyone was partying and having a good time that summer, and why not? You might not be alive the next year, and you know, people were expecting Hitler to drop gas bombs everywhere. You know, the gas bombs had been used by the Italians in Abyssinia, and that's why everyone was issued with gas masks. They'd been issued with gas masks as early as Munich Agreement of 1938. No one knew what was going to happen. I mean, the threat there really wasn't about the nuclear bomb, because very few people knew about it or understood it. It was there, the threat, but it wasn't known. What was known was the horror of gas bombs being dropped on cities.
A good time for a writer, because you can have those hedonistic scenes, as you do in Nucleus, people overindulging at parties, but also that fear, people walking around in gas masks, suspicion.
Yeah, and the unknown lay ahead of them. I mean, yeah, if you thought the world was going to end tomorrow, you'd probably be a good excuse for a party, wouldn't it? It's either that or sit there, you know, holding your head in your hands and screaming.
And Professor Tom Wilde, he's the hero of this book, and you've said yourself you created him to make up for the fact that you, unlike the predecessors in your family, haven't served in the military. Is that true?
Well, it's probably why I love thrillers so much, because, you know, I come from generations of military, and they all served very very gallantly in various wars. I think all the British wars going back to the mid-19th century. Yes, I sort of feel, you know, would I have been scared? Would I have measured up? I think all certainly men, I don't know if it's the same for women, but I think certainly all men wonder whether they'd measure up in times of war. And, you know, perhaps I wouldn't. maybe it's a bit precarious in writing about heroes like Tom Wilde, who's a very brave man, and my, you know, 16th century hero, John Shakespeare.
They are both brave men. And when we talked about the atmosphere of 1939, politically, you cover a big canvas. There's a lot going on there, isn't there? You've got kinder transport, appeasement, say the invasion of Czechoslovakia, growing Nazism in Germany, sympathisers in this country. Where did you start in terms of researching that?
Well, I spent time in Berlin. I spent a lot of time in Cambridge. I knew London anyway. So if you're talking about where in terms of place, where in terms of the events, I mean, I read about them all at the same time, really, because I had this idea of using the kinder transport, which I... Kinder transport was actually very big in Cambridge. A lot of those children came to Cambridge. There was a lot of local organisation to help them, particularly among the Quakers. The Quakers are amazing, and they're sort of... I'm not particularly religious myself, but I do admire what they did for all those children in the 1930s.
Well, you mention at the end of your book one particular woman, Bertha Bracey, who was extraordinary.
And she was a remarkable woman, and, you know, she... unsung heroine. People get, you know, knighthoods and damehoods for almost nothing nowadays, but there was a woman who saved 10,000 children through her tireless work over many months. These kinder transports, you think of one train bringing all these children. This was happening two or three times a week, every week, and they were bringing these children from Austria, Czechoslovakia, Germany, and the terror of the parents is difficult to understand, I think, now. You think, oh, you just put them on the train. They put them on a train going to... They knew not where, and they couldn't communicate via Skype or FaceTime with them. And they did it because they thought they were going to die. They thought this was the only option to save their children. And the people who helped them were remarkable.
And Bertha was based in Berlin, is that right?
She was based in London at Bloomsbury House. But they did have representatives in Berlin and in other parts of Germany and Czechoslovakia and Austria.
And you mentioned Cambridge there, and it's in Nucleus, Cambridge plays a key role, the development of the A-bomb, and you've got the Cavendish Laboratory. How much of that is true?
They certainly split the atom in the Cambridge laboratory. They had, you know, the top nuclear scientists in the world were based in Cambridge and in Germany, a place like Göttingen or Dahlem, in France, in Paris, and in universities in America. That's where this small world of nuclear physicists were working. And Cambridge had been preeminent throughout the 30s. This was where Rutherford and Cocroft and Walton and the others produced their remarkable advances.
And you, again, in the afterwards, you acknowledge the help given you by Alan Fry on particle physics.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean, you don't go into too much detail, thankfully, on particle physics in the book, but enough to be convincing. Is that a new area for you?
I was not very good at school at physics, and I've had to learn about it very quickly. And I love it, actually. And I wish I had taken more interest as a child in the sciences, because it is interesting, and particularly interesting are the scientists themselves. They're a remarkable bunch of people. I mean, it must have been fabulous working in the Cavendish in the 1930s, and they were a bit cavalier about it. You know, some of the assistants tended to lose fingers because they were using radioactive materials and weren't properly protected as they're using them and preparing them for the scientists. And they were holding machines together with rubber bands and bits of string and plasticine.
Yeah, as you say, oh, to be a fly on the wall there. And this is the second book featuring Professor Tom Wilde. Are you feeling him grow with you as a character? You're getting more familiar with him. Do you know where he's going, where his story is going?
I do know where he's going. And he doesn't come out of nowhere, Tom Wilde. He comes out of a desire by me to take a sort of wry look at the Evelyn War version of 1920s, 1930s student life, as you would come across in Brideshead Revisited, these rather wealthy, effete young men. I wanted somebody who was an outsider to that, so this is why he's American, but he's half Irish as well. And he is based on a couple of real people. When I say based, that's probably the wrong word. He's inspired by a couple of real people. One, Americans with strong connections to Britain. One was a chap called Conyers Reid, who wrote a biography of Walsingham. He was a historian, and he studied in England. And he went on to be one of the founders of the OSS, the Office of Strategic Studies, which was set up by America during the war and which became the CIA. So he actually took the elements of the 16th century spy network of Walsingham, which I know a lot about, and applied them, because he was a great admirer of Walsingham, and applied them to what became the CIA. So you've got that link between the 16th century and the modern world. Now, the other guy is James Jesus Angleton. Now, he also had strong links to England. He went to school here. And he was also in the OSS, and he became counterintelligence chief in the CIA. And importantly, he was very, very good friends with Kim Philby and was betrayed by Kim Philby. Brings you back to Cambridge, the Cambridge spies. So these are the two people who inspired me, who inspired Tom Wilde.
Well, yeah, it all comes back to Cambridge. Well, speaking of Cambridge, we'll hear now from Alison Bruce. Alison is the author of 8 crime novels, and her first, Cambridge Blue, introduced both detective Gary Goodhue and her trademark Cambridge setting. She's written 7 in total in the Goodhue series and been shortlisted twice for the Crime Writers Association Dagger in the Library Award. Her latest, I Did It For Us, is a standalone psychological thriller, and she explained to Gareth Farmer how she came to write it.
I'd read a book called I Let You Go by Claire McIntosh, and she was at an event I was going to in London, and I really wanted to meet her and say in person how much I'd enjoyed her book. I got there and I had a chat with her, and she was also talking to, I think, her editor or an editor. Anyway, I ended up talking to this woman who made a very brief comment, something along the lines of, it's not what you would have thought. As she said it, I had this kind of bolt of lightning experience where the whole book fell into my head in an instant. In fact, it was so complete, I actually wondered if it was a book I'd forgotten I'd previously read. And so I just left the event there and then, wandered off, sat in Trafalgar Square for about 2 hours, asked myself lots of questions about the plot, and found out that I really did have a complete book. The publisher loved it, and the deal was done in about a week. Basically, you're following Emily. It begins with sort of a catastrophe in Emily's life, really. She accuses her husband's best friend of raping her, and the book starts with a court case, and her life pretty much falls apart afterwards. That part of the story is actually a very small part of the book, and the main focus is when she moves and has to restart her life. She becomes friends with a woman, a young widow downstairs with 2 children, and quite quickly becomes obsessed with the idea that this woman, Joanne's new boyfriend, might be a danger to her or to the children.
Is it quite common for plots to emerge or plop into your head like that?
No. Normally I have to work at them really hard. I'll start with a concept. For example, with one of my books, I had the idea of a body in a lock-up garage, somebody hiding in a loft, and killing off one of my characters that had been through the series. So I started with those 3 ideas and then grew the book from there, adding in location and characters and then going back over it. And plotting is normally quite a long process.
Are there any sort of influences in terms of psychological thrillers that you have?
If you haven't read the Claire McIntosh book, I absolutely love that because there's a great twist in it. And I think when you're writing crime, you quite often see the twists coming. You know why certain things have been put in certain places, and you can see what devices are being used. And the twist in that completely blindsided me so much. I was sitting in bed reading the book, and I dropped the book. It sort of fell onto my lap, and I thought, wow. As far as what I've been reading recently, I've just read Mick Herron's London Rules, actually, which is spies and espionage and all of that, and obviously it's crime, but that was out of my comfort zone, if you like, but I'd really recommend that. That's a very good read.
One thing that I experienced reading the novel is that oscillation between sympathy with the character, between them sort of feeling like, you know, are they psychotic? The way in which you describe some of her behaviours throughout the novel are very intriguing, and it almost seemed to be designed to elicit, I don't know, rage or distrust from a reader.
Firstly, there's been a couple of times when I've been in quite traumatic situations, and when I look back at my own behaviour, I'll think, why did I do that or why did I say that? Because I haven't behaved in a totally measured way. With Emily, you're joining her at quite a traumatic point in her life. It's a bit of a crossroads. And things that she's relied upon, she now can't trust herself. So she's quite often going over different scenarios or worrying about different situations are going to evolve because she doesn't know herself. Because it's in the first person, you're getting the opportunity to be with her as she's going through those thought processes. She's not necessarily thinking clearly, but she's also not able to think clearly because she doesn't know what's going on herself.
It's quite an interesting ensemble of characters, actually, in the house that Emily eventually moves into. And one thing I enjoyed was not knowing quite how much of the characters' details were relevant to the plot. We have Frank gardening, and I often wondered, is he going to be involved in this intrigue? I
mean, what's in the garden? Yeah, what's in the flower bed?
Exactly.
I think it's a balance because you've got to make details count. You can't just put superfluous details in for the sake of it. But then you've got to put enough in to make your characters well-rounded. Most of those points will pay off in terms of characterisation, but some of them will pay off in terms of the way the plot delivers later on. It's getting that balance right. You can't load the reader with a load of fluff that's taking them nowhere, because that's just frustrating.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned earlier was this trial at the beginning that lingers over the whole novel. And one of the things that I was thinking when I was reading it is that actually a lot of the issues that you discuss about sexual harassment, about rape, about victims' witness statements and the truth or lack of truth or grey areas and that is very topical. Do you think that's where the ideas came from in some ways? Or
when I thought of this book, all of that really wasn't on the horizon any more than it always has been. I had done quite a bit of research for previous books on certain topics, such as self-harm was one. One of my books had some rape evidence in it, things like this. So there was an amalgamation of things that I'd read up on before. And I spent several days in court in Cambridge, in the court that's described in the book. It was really a combination of things that I'd researched previously and things that were of interest to me. And it just happens that I suppose the front of the book is quite topical, but equally that probably means that it's in danger of being in a market that's sort of saturated with that kind of thing.
One of the great things about reading a novel like this is the pleasure for a reader, really, when one of the characters, Matt, finds himself on Bennett Street and going to the Eagle Pub. Do you know much about your readership? I mean, is your readership primarily based in Cambridge? Obviously, you'd have an international audience, but do you get much feedback about your readership?
I have a strong local following, which is lovely, and I do have readers, mainly English-speaking world. I've got quite a few in Australia and America. Although this book's not all set in Cambridge, the way the other books have, so Cambridge features less strongly. I think it's really important for people who live locally to be able to read the book and recognise places, not think, oh, I wonder where that is, or, oh, well, it's not like that. It makes me very, very happy when local people say, I know exactly that spot, or, you know, I used to live around the corner from that, or, you know, I fell down the stairs there, or whatever it is. You know, writing about somewhere that is so vibrant and interesting and diverse always makes a good backdrop for a story.
Some films your readers might like to know what you're working on next and whether you will continue to write some sort of psychological thrillers or whether the next project might be a crime novel and, crucially, I suppose, will DC Goodhue be back?
I'm working on a book at the moment that is geographically very much in the mould of the Goodhue books. It's not featuring a police detective. It's featuring a character who moves back to Cambridge. He needs to kind of start again for completely different reasons to Emily, and as soon as he moves back to Cambridge, a murder happens pretty much outside his house, and it goes from there. At the moment, it's a standalone book, but it's got the potential to become a series, so that's what I'm working on next. I'm not planning another Gary book at the moment. It's not to say I won't. I mean, I did 7 of them, and I always knew there was this crossroads coming up where I would leave Goodhue, and that would give me the opportunity to come back to the series if I want to and reboot it with a slightly different flavour. But I always thought I'd get to that point and then see how things developed in my head with Gary, but also if a case comes up at some point where I think, oh, I need Gary for this one, then I'll go with it. But I have written some short stories featuring him, and I'd like to write some more. I'd like it eventually to do an anthology of short stories. I think I've done 4 at the moment, if I can get up to 12. But I have to focus on this other book. And one of the features of the other book is a character who is studying crime and investigation. And that's really going to give me a strong secondary character in the next book.
That was Gareth Farmer there talking to Alison Bruce. And I Did It For Us is published by Little Brown. You're listening to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. And our studio guest is Rory Clements, talking about his psychological thriller, really, Nucleus, I beg your pardon. Alison talking there, Rory, about Cambridge and, you know, how enjoyable it is for her when people recognise parts of Cambridge in her novel. Of course, in your novel, Cambridge very much a central character as well. But we're talking about 1939 Cambridge.
Very different, I think, to present-day Cambridge. If you walk around Cambridge now, it's full of tourists any time of the year. It's the colleges are both male and female, and they're completely mixed. In those days, if you're a woman, you couldn't even get a degree until 1948. There were about 5,000 young men and about 500 women at Girton and Newnham. The place was covered in smoke from the chimney of Thompson's Lane power station, and from all the exhaust fumes and the cigarette smoking endlessly, and 10,000 personal chimneys in people's houses. Buildings were blackened. You can still see it in places, the black buildings, but everything was blackened there. It's a very different feel to the place. It was also a much smaller place then. It was sort of half market town, half university. During the term times, of course, it was predominantly university, and then all the students left. This university was still there, but it became a small market town again. I think it is very different now. So I've had to think myself back into that time. I've known and loved Cambridge for many years, but I had to imagine myself into a different Cambridge.
And how do you know that it was like that?
Well, I've read a lot about it. There's a lot of pictures about it. There's old film. It's quite accessible. And you can read the books of someone, C.P. Snow, set in 1930s Cambridge.
All right, well, let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is the Rolling Stones and Not Fade Away. Why this one?
Well, I went to a boarding grammar school. My parents were abroad, and, you know, there is a few boarding grammar schools around the country. It was a state school, but I was there, and we didn't have access to a lot of music or anything, really. But we had transistor radios. We all had these little transistor radios which you hold up to your ear, and the radio sort of came and went. But I was wandering through the grounds, and this record came on, Not Fade Away by the Rolling Stones. I'd never heard anything like it, and it absolutely blew me away. I thought, this is the best thing I've ever heard. I didn't know music could be so good. And so that's why I'd like that.
Mark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our studio guest on Bookmark today is Rory Clements. We're talking about his novel, Nucleus. You're going to read now for us, Rory.
I will, yes. At the beginning of Nucleus, Tom Wilde is in America, but this is him arriving home. Tom Wilde arrived back in Cambridge in the early afternoon of a warm day in early June, a week before the end of term. Back in March when he left, he'd leant into a blustering squall of rain as he struggled into the station. Now, as he stepped out of the train, the sky spoke of a proper English summer. But for all that, he was dismayed by the view from the taxi window, so great were the changes wrought on the town by impending war. Sandbags were being piled high on the pavement around several public buildings, including the police station on St. Andrew Street and the Magistrates' Court. A band of about 30 Boy Scouts was marching down the road just before Jesus Lane. The taxi and other vehicles had to stop to let them past. Several cyclists rang their bells in frustration. The scouts, shoulders back, knees bare beneath khaki shorts, carried a banner that said defiantly, "We're ready, are you?" Wilde smiled, the optimism and certainty of youth. "Looks like everyone's getting set for war," he muttered. The driver picked up his remark. "Sad but true, sir. I found myself in an allotment out Cherry Hinton way, no more than 130 foot, and planted spuds and more spuds. That'll see the family through for a few months if worse comes to worst." He turned briefly to look at his passenger. "Is this your first time, Cambridge, may I ask?" Wilde laughed. "Lived and worked here about 5 years now." "You sound like an American gentleman, sir." "Something like that." The traffic was moving again. Wilde wound down the window. The cab was stuffy and thick with stale cigarette smoke, and he was impatient to get home. He wondered what awaited him. One of the books he had read during his time at sea was Priestley's English Journey. He had been amused by his brief but excoriating description of Cambridge as being primly pleased with itself. Wilde could not but agree, but Priestley had also commented that it was a lovely old place, far lovelier now than Oxford, and Wilde had agreed with that too. At last the taxi pulled up outside his modest Georgian house. While the driver struggled with his bags, Wilde opened the front door and was confronted by spotless cleanliness and the floral whiff of potent household products. Doris, the charlady he shared with Lydia Morris, his next-door neighbour, had been busy preparing the place for his homecoming. It was certainly an improvement on the smoke pollution he'd endured in the cab and on the train from Southampton. Even in the dining car, the food had had a faint flavour of soot. He unstrapped one of his bags and pulled it open. On the top was a new Billie Holiday disc. He had been captivated by her rendering of a dark and devastating song about a lynching, but he hadn't been able to find it on record, so he had bought everything else he could find by her in a local store in New York. He located the record player on a low table beside the wireless and put on These Foolish Things. He turned up the volume. The sweet sound brought new life to the house. When the song had finished, he showered, then dressed in clean white shirt and flannels, and stepped out from the front door. His eye caught the red pillar box on the pavement at the far end of Lydia's house. The words "An Phoblacht Abu" had been written, hurriedly painted in dripping black. Wilde grimaced. He knew well enough the meaning of the words. The Republic forever. He knew too the implication. IRA sympathisers were in town. Word had reached the American newspapers of their activities in England these past few months. Over 100 explosions around the country since the beginning of the year. So that's just a beginning of Wilde in England.
And that's what kicks it all off. To talk to Alison about plotting earlier. What about, how do you plot, Rory? Because you have so many plots in Nucleus, but they all tie together. They all link to. But is it post-it notes on a blackboard?
I don't use post-it notes. No, I write it out, not longhand, but they're very long involved plots I write. They hopefully all slot together. Sometimes you get into a bit of a muddle. It can be as long as a novella, actually, my notes. You know, it takes me about 6 months of working on a plot before I start writing a book.
Really? Six months? So I suppose when you start writing, you can do so with confidence?
Yes. I know where I'm going with it. I know how it's going to end. One of the most frustrating things in any form of novel or TV show, I think, is if you're let down by the ending. So I never want to let my readers down with an ending that sort of just drifts away.
And as I mentioned earlier, your background was in journalism and now you've moved to novel writing. How did the first novel come about and the publication of that?
I was very lucky, I suppose. All my life I've tried to write, but holding down a full-time job in newspapers, I'm not probably a very good multitasker. I need to concentrate on what I'm doing. So, was it 13 years ago, 11 years ago? I moved up to Norfolk because I'd had enough of newspapers and I thought they'd probably had enough of me. And I had been working on this plan to do a series of 16th century thrillers. For about 15 years I'd been doing research on it and working it out. And I wrote off to an agent with the idea, and she very kindly got back to me within a day or two and said she liked the idea, but she needed a book. So I spent the next 6 months writing it, and she immediately picked it up, and she sold it into America within a couple of weeks in this country very soon after that. So I was very, very lucky.
And that was the beginning. Yeah. Well, let's stay with publishers and writers indeed. Writing as B.K. Duncan, Ruth Wade is the author of the May Keeps crime series, of which the second novel, Foul Trade, was shortlisted for the People's Book Prize. Her latest novel, Walls of Silence, is a historical thriller published by Bloodhound Books, an independent publisher based in Cambridge and run by Fred Freeman and Betsy Reevely. I met Betsy and Ruth and started by asking Betsy to tell me about Bloodhound.
Bloodhound Books is predominantly crime and thriller publisher of e-books. That's where our focus lies. It started in August 2014. We now publish over 80 authors and approximately 10 books a month. It's gone from strength to strength since the beginning. And I think we can safely say we're now one of the leading independent publishers in the UK.
And you say ebooks, why did you choose to specialise in ebooks rather than paper books, if you like?
Because we felt that we could compete on the ebook platform much better than we could do on shelves. We can't compete with Penguin and print 200,000 books in one go and get them onto the bookshelves in the same way that we can produce ebooks and compete with the bigger traditional publishers, which is what we do.
It's still a very competitive market, though.
It's very tough. Lots of independent publishers go bust and really struggle. We've been extremely lucky, I think, in that we've found a recipe for success.
And why specialising in crime?
Because that's what I write, and it's what I read, and it's what I love. They always say, do what you know, and for me to have picked up any other genre would have been foolish.
What is it you love about crime?
I love all dark stories. I'm fascinated by what makes people tick and makes them do bad things or make wrong decisions. That's what I like to write about, and it's what I like to read about.
Ruth, how did you find Bloodhound Books?
I can't remember whether it was on a tweet. It was your logo that I saw first. So it was something on the web, and I followed through to your website and saw that you were Cambridge and just thought, yeah, I like the sound of this company, and mentioned it to my agent, and the rest is history, really.
And you've
best decision I ever made.
Excellent. Yes. So you know, qualms about working with a small press? Would you rather work with a larger one? Clearly not.
What I wanted was to be a middle fish in a growing pond, and I'm learning a lot, and I'm learning a lot about marketing. But I feel as though I'm being supported and can grow. And Betsy's been very willing to take a risk with my books and what I want to write and where I want to go. A big publisher, a traditional publisher, would not do that. The potential for failure in money terms is too great. So I was turned down a lot for my recent book, Walls of Silence, by all the major publishers, actually, because it wouldn't sell. It is selling, and it's selling very well. But it's because Betsy and Fred have been willing to take a risk, and a bigger publisher just wouldn't do that.
So, Betsy, when you read Walls of Silence, you thought, we want this for our list?
Absolutely. And as far as I'm concerned, it wasn't a risk, because it's beautifully written and it's a fantastic story. As Ruth says, it's selling exceptionally well. We're selling over 100 copies a day. It's nicely received in the US as well as from UK reviewers. It was a no-brainer as far as we were concerned. This book needed to be published, and that's what we did.
So Walls of Silence is coming out with Bloodhound. What happens to your back catalogue?
I write standalone books. I also write as B.K. Duncan, a 1920s series. Bloodhound had published the first two of those books already. I'm hoping that Bloodhound will pick up my backlist, and then what I will have is a body of work with the same publisher, and each book and each readership feeds off each other. I don't write one sort of book or one sort of story, and therefore what I would like to have is a publisher that will support me in trying, being the best writer I can possibly be, which means trying different books in different ways and getting better as a writer.
And is there something about being with the one publisher that gives you a cohesive identity as a writer?
Yes, it gives me security. I feel safe. I feel that I can explore different ideas of what I want to write. I can talk it over. Betsy and I can talk about the sort of avenue I might go with the next book. I can get some advice. I can get some support, and we'll be supported all the way through. And it's... I'm going to cry in a minute. It's someone having faith. My agent's always... Caroline has always had faith in me. But Betsy and Fred have faith in me, and that means so much. I've been doing this for 20 years. I've been doing my apprenticeship for 20 years and knocking against closed doors, and the doors have opened, and it's fabulous.
This is a nice job you have, Betsy. Look, you're supporting writers.
Absolutely. It's my favourite part of it, really. Working with talented people who deserve to have their voice heard is what it's all about, as far as I'm concerned. I went into starting Bloodhound with my husband. I came at it from being a writer myself and finding I had plenty of doors slammed in my face too. We are able, because of this sort of ebook revolution, to publish a lot of people who otherwise may not have been given the chance, which is such a pity. And one of the things that astounds me is the level of talent that is actually out there. There's this nonsense idea that agents have this so-called slush pile of submissions. I think that's absolute nonsense. The quality of most of the stuff we get through is great. We can't publish all of it, but generally, most people who are able to write an entire book can actually string a sentence together, and I think to call it a slush pile is rather offensive, to say the least. Not something we ever do.
And, Ruth, is there something about being with a publisher who just publishes crime that you're amongst friends, really? You've got a support network, you're in a stable of like-minded authors.
Yes, I think crime as a genre has always been seen as a lesser genre. It's not quite as low as being a poet, but it's sort of down there, which is totally unfair. There's a respectability to the best writing in every single genre. And there's something about being given permission, I think. I'm not sure if it's that I feel at home, but I do feel that I have permission to explore what I want to write, as long as it's within the broad envelope of crime and thriller. I have some difficulty with the labels in subgenres. I don't think I fit. I don't want to write in order to fit a subgenre. I want to write and discover where I am, and there's a difference to that. But obviously there are also marketing issues, and obviously I appreciate that, and I'm not trying to be precious about my work and say whatever I write, that's it. It is about writing for the market. It is about selling books. It is about me saying something that I want to say in a way that other people can take as entertainment, as a story, as information, as education, however they want to take it. But for that, they have to buy it. They have to want to buy it. They have to invest their time and their money in what I've written. And therefore, I owe them to write something that meets their expectations. And so if it's crime, thriller, psychological, within that broad envelope, I fit somewhere there.
Yeah, it's a broad envelope, Betsy, isn't it, crime? There's a genre and subgenre within it.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the exciting things about publishing it, because, you know, one minute you can be dealing with a sort of very modern police procedural type novel, the next minute you're dealing with Walls of Silence by Ruth, which is, you know, a sort of historical, almost sort of psychological suspense thriller. And you never know what what's going to come in and also to an extent what's going to sell. But it's fun learning.
So looking to the future then, let's move ahead 5 years. Where would you see Bloodhound then?
I would like to see it become a publisher that can get paperbacks onto shelves much more easily than we do currently, although we produce paperbacks for every single novel we publish. As of yet, we're not able to get them stocked in every single Waterstones across the country or, you know, on the aisles of Tesco, where all the big publishers are able to make headway. At the moment, this isn't something we can do, and that is something I would like to be able to change in the future, and hopefully as the company grows and we get more and more recognition and deal with great writers like Ruth, then we stand a chance of that happening.
And Ruth, what about you? What's next for you?
Betsy and I were just talking about this. Very possibly another standalone. Again, in the 1920s, I always write my books set in the 1920s. There's something about that era that is a parallel to the sorts of issues and society now. And I think looking back at the past teaches us a lot about the present. Plus the fact it was before forensics and mobile phones. And it's a time that I'm more comfortable writing about, because I can concentrate on the characters and not the gadgets.
Now, it's Ruth Wade and Betsy Reevely there. And Walls of Silence by Ruth is published, as we heard, by Bloodhound Books. And you can find out more about Bloodhound Books and Walls of Silence on their website, bloodhoundbooks.com. We're coming to the end of our time with you on Bookmark, Rory Clements, I'm afraid. But let's bring us up to date. What are you writing at the moment? Presumably you're writing the third part, or have you written the third part of this trilogy?
I am writing the third part. Whether it's a trilogy, I don't know yet, but I have got an idea for a fourth one, but I'm close to the end of the third one at the moment, which has set in 1939 again, but a few months later. It's set at the end of August, beginning of September, which were pretty crucial days. It sort of starts just after the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, then the beginning of the war, and into the first 2 weeks of the war.
And Ruth's saying there, you know, you can use the past to shine a light on the present. Have you, researching this period, have you found parallels between that time and this time?
I hope not, because we know how it ended.
Yes.
I don't think it feels so critical at the moment. I really don't. I mean, I don't really think that... Well, I hope I'm wrong, but I really don't think feels like a beginning of, you know, the edge of World War. But I think it did in 1939. I think it was so obvious that Hitler was so ravenous and so acquisitive of land that he wasn't going to stop. Nothing would stop him. He was a man who would not take no for an answer.
And finally, the question that we ask all our guests here on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Funnily enough, I'm reading a book which hasn't been published yet. I was asked to read it, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. It's called The Angel's Mark. It's by somebody called S.W. Perry, and it's set in late 16th century, my earlier period. And it's good, really good fun. The other book I'm reading, more to the point of my researches, is the diary of Guy Liddell, who was the head of the MI5 during the Second World War. And he wrote a diary, and he kept a diary throughout the war, which was put away in a safe in the MI5 offices for many, many years, and was finally published in, I think, the 1990s. And it's quite a remarkable book.
Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment to find out what your final choice of music is. Lovely talking to you today, Rory. A Nucleus by Rory Clements is published by Zafra Publishing. Heads up on our next show. Studio guest on that show is Ruth Fidjest talking about her novel Magnetism, which is the story of a fraught mother-daughter relationship, something maybe some of us can relate to, that spans 50 years. We'll also hear from poets Aphrodite Nicol and J.S. Watts. All the old episodes of Bookmark are on the Cambridge 105 Radio website, which is cambridge105.co.uk. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Rory, which is Graceland by Paul Simon. Why this one?
Well, I think it just sort of speaks to all human beings, really. It's a song about lost love. He had just broken up his marriage, I believe, when he wrote it. And you know, he has that line, losing love is like a window in your heart. Everyone sees you're blown apart. And it always sends a chill down my spine.